I'm your daddy.
I can be smart when it's important.
I'm your daddy.
Welcome to Daddy Dailies, a podcast hosted by Not Your Daddy's Films. On a film set, dailies are sent out after a shoot day so you can see the work in progress. Daddy Dailies are conversations that go behind the scenes so you can see what work went into the process and be better armed to succeed in the industry. Daddy Dailies, hosted by Not Your Daddy's Films. Not Your Daddy's Films is a social impact organization dedicated to empowering and educating women and non-binary creatives in TV and film. We're not your old daddies. We are new and improved. I'm a daddy. You're a daddy. We're all daddies here.
Welcome back to Daddy Dailies. I'm Vika.
And I'm Carly.
Two of the co-founders of Not Your Daddy's Films. Our guest today, I met pre-pandemic doing stand-up. She was a joy to watch and a joy to get to know. And it really wasn't until after watching her perform that I learned about all her other accomplishments. Today's guest was the head writer on the Emmy-nominated series The Problem with Jon Stewart, has written on shows like Girls 5 of a, Not Dead Yet, Bless This Mess, and The Opposition with Jordan Klepper. She wrote, directed, and starred in her 2020 South by Southwest short Basic, and has a hit podcast, I can speak English, formerly called Celebrity Book Club, now called Glamorous Trash, of which I am personally an avid listener. And she has a memoir coming out this June 2024 called I Shouldn't Be Telling You This, But I'm Going to Anyway. Chelsea Devantes, welcome to Daddy Dailies.
I'm so happy to be here. Such a fan of yours. I've been watching you make your films. And also, I don't know if you guys know this, but you know, when you get your first writing job, one of your friends will be like, you should form an LLC to save money on your taxes. And then it's so overwhelming because all you've done your whole life is get money back because they took all your money. And then there's this one year where it's like, form an LLC and then you have to name it. And yes, maybe 10 years ago, I named my LLC My Own Daddy because I'm my own daddy.
Yes, you are.
Yes, and it's on my credit card. And when people, sometimes bartenders are like, is this a porn company? I'm like, you wish.
I'm like, could be, multi-hyphenate central.
Never know. Could your wiki feed fund my feature? I'm in.
Not opposed.
Okay, let's get to it, you guys.
So Chelsea, you are a true multi-hyphenate, which is something we talk about all the time at Not Your Daddy's. And not to mention you have a husband and also a dog who need your time and attention. So the very first question is, when do you sleep? And after that, a more serious question, has it been hard for you, especially early on in your career, to navigate what exactly you want to pursue? Because I think a lot of director, actor, writer, producers worry that choosing just one path in the moment means giving up their other passions, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. Well, for the sleep question, I'm a double Taurus with a Capricorn rising. I love to sleep. What I have given up is cleaning, cooking in any way, even having a nice snack, grocery shopping well. Like, all of that stuff is just dismal in my life. It's painful. But that is the stuff that I let go to the wayside. But sleep will never leave my life. And it's funny. My husband has said to me, he was like, I've never seen someone need more alone time in my life, but it's not alone time. I just love my work projects. So I just need to get the work stuff done. But I was always like, this is a normal cadence. And very luckily he's the same as me. So we just mutually work and then meet for a shitty dinner that I pulled out of our freezer. And then as to, was it hard? Yeah, absolutely. Because I think, well, at least where I grew up in small towns in the Southwest. I also grew up pretty poor and didn't have TV for a lot of life. And so I just didn't have a reference point for a lot of art that people had. So I thought the options were Julia Roberts or Sandra Bullock. And I was a brunette, so I was like, let's try and be Sandra Bullock. But that's where you get to be funny and make heartfelt, meaningful rom-coms. And it took me a long time to learn about the people behind the camera and the people writing. And also those people weren't, especially then, it's still now, women. So it doesn't really seem possible. So I really discovered writing when I was a performer at the Second City, and you write all your own material. Mm-hmm. And so that's when I discovered, oh my God, I've been a writer the whole time. I also journaled. The amount I journaled as a child should have put me in an institution. Someone should have seen me journaling and been like, something's wrong, put her away. Like, she's conjuring something, or like she's planning something, or she's like a child in the FBI. Like, it was something was wrong with me. But
you still have those, yeah?
Yeah, the 21 of them. And they're those Blick or Borders art books. So they're not like little cute journals. They are those like 500 pages.
Yes.
eight by 11 white blank pages that I just filled. But yeah, so it came to me, my love of writing came late. I also had a teacher in high school write my recommendation letter for college, and I obviously opened it and read it. Come on, what, are we not doing that? He was like, she doesn't know it yet, but she's actually a director. And I was like, fuck you, I'm an actress. Like, are you saying I'm bad at acting? And then like years later, I was like,
the creative urge to be like, that is a bad thing you just said. It means I'm not good at my other. Because I did the same thing.
He taught me acting classes. I was totally. Like, wait a minute. Like,
what?
Yeah, he was my drama teacher. No, totally. And it was a very hard choice. And I would like to say like, oh, you don't have to make a choice, you can do it all, but you can't. You definitely can't. Like, the moment you really become a TV writer on a show that's not your own, you cannot audition. Like, contractually, you are in first position to the network for that job. If you're also developing stuff, you're then in second position for like those other things. And so, and then you need money, right? So when the next job comes, you're like, I need money, I love writing. You know, you take the next job. Now you haven't really been auditioning for a year. And you guys know what that does, like when you kind of pull yourself away from your agent who barely pays attention to you anyway. Like, what are you doing? Wait, I'm gonna sneeze.
That's you.
You're allergic.
I'm allergic to what I'm saying. So... definitely, I knew like I was kind of letting acting not go entirely, but I knew that I was probably only going to be an actor in stuff that I wrote and created because, you know, if you're supposed to be in a writer's room for 5 months at a time, that's a usual contract. You can't book anything during that. So then you would really have to take your time off to act. So it is possible, but it definitely makes it harder. And I have other friends who are very similar multi-hyphenates to me. And all of us are in the same position of like, oh, I have to put myself in it. Or when I pitch shows, I have to pitch them as me in it because you need to do like 100 auditions to get one great role. And you need to have time to do that.
Yeah. I think that's like I'm in that early stage where I'm on my first show and I'm in a writer's room and I had to do that. I was like pre-pandemic, I was auditioning a ton. And then I got the show, like I started working on the show in 2021, I think. And like I wasn't auditioning anyway because it was COVID and I'm not famous. Mm-hmm. I was like, okay, riding the horse in the direction it's going. But now it has become that crossroads of like, okay, so this is what I'm doing and I love it. And yeah, if I want to act, I'm going to have to keep, you know, putting myself in my own shorts or whatever.
Absolutely. Well, and then you get on the other side where like you're watching all of the under fives auditions as a writer in the room to help choose them, or you're having conversations with network execs and showrunners of like who to choose and who to cast and what they're saying. And then when you hear all of that, you go, Oh my God. It's so horrible. It's so horrible. Like, am I going to put myself through this? Because now I know what it's like. Now I know.
Yeah.
They always say like, you know, you can't control an audition. You never know what goes into it. But what goes into it is sometimes 97% bullshit. And so to know that you got up, you got dressed, you put makeup on, you learned the lines, you gave it your all, you felt weird in the waiting room, you ran into someone you fucking hate, you ran into someone you love, the casting director was odd to you, you think you did a good job, then you left. And for me to know with surety on the other side of it, none of it mattered, it's painful. It's painful. Yeah. And I'm not saying that as like, don't get up and act. I'm saying you have to be strong to be in this business, but to be an actor, you are conjuring something beautiful and strong every single day that is... hard to have energy for if you're also giving your energy to other things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely.
And I think it's good, I think, too, for actors to start to really understand what is going on the other side, like in a real way, that it is nothing matters. I mean, it matters.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It all matters, but it's beyond not in your control. Like,
Right.
I've seen people say, like, oh, we just cast a blonde girl in this scene, so the next girl has to be a brunette. And then there's 20 blondes in the audition room who haven't even gone yet. And it's, and you're already out. You're already out. Right. That was something I witnessed as an intern. I was like, oh my God.
You're like, oh no.
Right. I still pursued this career for 13 more years and we're still going. So
yeah. And I think honestly though, that should like encourage the multi-hyphenate in a way. It's like, if you want to be one thing, you kind of have to like really learn about all of the other things, and you never know what you're going to love. And also loving and being good at one thing doesn't negate another.
Absolutely. And the more you can be in control of your own work and create your own work, the happier I believe you will be in this business. And it's definitely what makes me happy, is the more I can be in control of the art I'm creating, the art I'm acting in, all of that.
Yeah. Well, let's rewind for a quick second. You said you grew up in the Southwest and you didn't necessarily have a TV all the time. So how did you end up? I think you were in New York first and then L.A. Did you like discover you did want to work in TV, and was it maybe like theater first, or like what avenue did you see for yourself?
Yeah, I was a theater kid, a choir girl. I played
Got to.
We all end up here. we know. So I tried for my choir solos. I was in like some school plays, and then but I was the first person in my family to go to college. So I really had the pressure to make that matter. And then I threw all of it away and went to acting school. So what was the point? What was the fucking point, was to say? And I remember feeling like I was making the decision between like being able to take care of my mom one day or possibly failing everyone, and including myself, if I did not make it. That's a lot of pressure to have like when you're 17. I'd been through so many hard things at that point, and the only thing that made me feel better was art. And so I kind of felt like any idea of a stable, somewhat normal life had already been taken from me. So I might as well just like go all the way and do the thing I like. And I was so dumb in my head. I was like, I guess you have to go to Broadway? I was like, Broadway, that seems like where you go. And I understood that you audition for plays. So I was like, that seems right. I don't even know how I'd get to LA. Like I had no idea. So I only applied to schools on the East Coast and around New York City and in New York City, and then went straight to New York City from New Mexico, showed up in overalls and a free T-shirt from a marathon I didn't run. And I did not do well in that city. The culture shock was so intense. I mean, it ate me up. And
oh, man.
Very luckily, I had done a semester abroad.
Oh, where did you do it?
The international city of Chicago, Illinois. And I had found this program started by Anne Libra where you could study comedy for a semester. And if you went into your school's admin and pitched a fit, they could give you credit for it, like I did to my school. I was like, I need to go to this program. And she has since turned it into a college major through Columbia College where you can major in comedy. And moving to Chicago and seeing the community there, and also, I mean, you can't have community if you're working 80 hours a week in New York City just to barely pay rent. How are you supposed to like go to shows all the time and meet up with people all the time? It's just, I couldn't do it. I had no money. And in Chicago, I could. In Chicago, there was like a $300 room for rent with no windows. And I was like, that's for me. And really had a beautiful, beautiful time there. So I went to Chicago from New York City, spent 8 years in Chicago doing Second City, then went back to New York City for my first TV job, then did another TV job there, then quit and came to LA, then worked a bunch of jobs in LA, then went back to New York City to be John Stewart's head writer, then came back to LA for the job I have now. So it's a lot of years.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. You were truly our city high coastal. Yeah.
Yeah.
When you went back and you had money and you had a job, did you feel differently about the city? Or
It was fucking devastating. I went back as the head writer for The Problem with Jon Stewart with head writer money. And I was like, New York City's a dream. What a beautiful place to live. Wow, I'm Carrie Bradshaw. Like, and let me tell you this. I went back to New York City. My first job as a TV writer was for Jon Stewart on a HBO show that actually never aired. But I was working for him for a year with staff writer salary. And New York City fucked me up. Like, I did not, I was not able to enjoy the city at all. I mean, it's a, you can definitely do it without money, but it's a tough city.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. The rats are bigger than me.
Yeah.
But the,
that's like your pizza.
You'll take your pizza. And that was, you know, even if you got it at Joseph's, like $2. I grew up just outside New York City. My mom's a New Yorker, and I always wanted to live there, and I still haven't, because I ended up going to school out here. But I when I talk to like interns or people who are trying to figure out where to move, I always kind of say I personally find LA an easier city to struggle in. There's like, you get more for your money, and you can be outside in a park if you like trees and all that. Like, yes, there's Central Park, but I think there's something to struggling here that is slightly easier. You can always take a dip in the ocean.
Completely agree.
You know, we think that we're supposed to go to New York. For some reason, that's the first thing I think most people think. It's like, yeah. Oh, if you do anything in this, it's like, I guess Broadway. Why is that all we know, you know? But there are other options.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, you're looking for like, what's the ground floor door? And at least Broadway holds open calls. And so you're like, mm-hmm. Yes, you know?
So,
yeah. Yeah, but I mean, I remember my classmates looking down on me for leaving New York City and going to Chicago. Like, I was a failure. Yeah. And I had that in my heart, too, of like, but I just didn't have another choice. I just didn't have the money to stay. But
100%.
So I just say, go where you can have an artistic community, wherever that is. Because every time that's happened, I just read Kathleen Hanna's memoir, who did Bikini Kill, and they were all in Olympia, Washington. And they created such an artistic movement that Nirvana, Bikini Kill, like Leader so Kenny, cool. All come out of that. And so it's just like, go where your community is, because
yeah,
that's kind of what's most important.
Or like, where is it exciting to you? You know, like I went to school for musical theater. I moved to New York and I was like, abso-fucking-lutely not. Like, I got there and I was like, this fucking sucks. And I, a few months later, moved to LA, and my classmates, my whole fit, everybody thought I was crazy. But I was like, I don't know what to tell you, but like, this is what I want to do. And had no idea why.
Good for you for being strong enough, because I think we feel all this pressure of like how you're supposed to do the career, the rubric of the career, what's the right decision to make. And it's so hard to turn your back on that and do what's right for yourself.
Yeah. For sure.
So slight tangent, because you said the first job was with Jon Stewart, but that show didn't end up going. So how did you, you know, we've fast forwarded and you're applying for these jobs. How did you figure out like, OK, I can be a writer and I can apply to these things and then end up getting that first job with like a, you know, fairly high profile person?
Well, that came out of so. Okay, first of all, hot plug for my book. So I had a comedy partner, and we made short films and web series and all these things, and it really took off. And we sold the show, and then this crazy thing happens. You have to read the book, and everything goes away, and I'm left with like literally nothing. And I was performing at the Second City Chicago. I was on their main stage, and I knew like. It was my third main stage. I knew I wasn't going to have a future there when the show was over. You kind of get like three shows and then you kind of, you're transitioned to something else. And so I knew time was up in July. And I had just lost all my writing samples because they were as a duo. I lost all of the momentum I had in any meetings I had ever gotten because it was as a duo. Everything I'd ever filmed and shot was as a duo. So you couldn't really, one, I'd already had this momentum, but then also to be like, hey, she wrote half of this. Like, it doesn't work. And I had nothing. And I was really, really depressed because I had this friend breakup. And so I realized that the only job I knew of was late night writing packets, because sometimes an intern would forget to block the email address and anyone could put the packet in and they would be sent around and shared among friends. Again, that community thing of like, I just got a packet for Colbert, and like, maybe they'll read it if you just send it in. They won't check that you don't have an agent or whatever. And I just put, you know, I worked at Second City. I loved satire. I was like, I just put everything I had into writing packets. And finally, one of them was for this like very odd show, and I recognized it was for Busboy, which was John's production company, but it didn't say anything else, and the packet was really out of the box, so in terms of what it was asking for. And I did this packet, and it got in. Next day, it was like, John read your packet. So first off, he had left the show. So he read, yeah, the show wasn't set up. So the packets went to John, and John read them, which is like,
so cool.
I love sharing that story because people always believe no one is reading your packets. And then when I became head writer, I read every single one of the 2,000 plus packets that came in. It's like, I just, you know, yes, it's true sometimes, but sometimes someone is reading them. And yeah, so I got that job and moved to New York City, and it didn't go for a year, and it went away. And he did something incredible, which is that he had negotiated severance for everyone who works there at HBO. And so I was 30 years old, and I finally had like money to put in some savings, and like I didn't have to get a job tomorrow. I needed a job in 2 months. That's how much money I had to live. So I was like, okay, I have 2 months. I started putting in, I think I did 11 packets in like 1 month. Wow. And it was so brutal. And I did this packet for the opposition, and they called me and they were like, hey, we read through 6 months of your Twitter. I was like, well, thank God I've been putting in the work.
Yes, seriously. Yes.
Oh my God.
Taking a picture of my coffee every morning. They were like, we read through 6 months of your Twitter, and John called us and recommended you. Now we'll let you into the interview process.
Oh my God.
Now then I interviewed for that job and got that job.
Now we'll let you into the interview process.
Yes.
The hoops. Yeah. But also you, like you said, you're putting in the work, because I think, you know, there's that metaphor of like, you know, we see the iceberg as it peeks out over the water, but we don't see like everything that's been building underneath the ocean. And it's like, you just see the success. So it's like, yeah, you have to be. Yeah. The reason I think most people get into this is this like undying love for whatever your passion is, writing, you know, creating, being an artist and wanting to tell stories. And then like, it's really hard. But if you continue to work, like maybe I'm naive, but I feel like I'll be naive for the rest of my life. I'm like, if you work really hard and you don't give up, like eventually something's gonna hit.
That's absolutely true, because think of all the people who fucking suck at this and have success.
Yeah,
like
absolutely.
Nothing is more inspiring than looking at someone just absolutely bad rise to the top, and you go, yeah, they just kept at it, man. So maybe I should too. I should too. And honestly,
Hollywood, baby.
Those people will always do better than you. So it's even going to take you longer. But they did it, and you can too.
Yes.
Yeah. I think too, there's something to be said, yeah, about going just balls to the wall.
On something.
Like, you writing those packets, like, that's amazing. That's
And it's
inspiration.
I think it's tough to give that advice, but it is the only advice I know. We are in a capitalist system, which means bootstraps and ruining yourself. And it's what I did. And it's, I don't know any other way, because we're in a really fucked up system. And I want to say, importantly, had that show not been canceled in the way it was, and severance was possible because it was being taken away, I would have never had the time to write all those packets. Mm-hmm. That's why most people in this business are nepo babies, do come from money, do have backup plans. How would I have ever done that many packets if I was also working a job? And so I also think it's important that, like, when we get these jobs, to like try and change this system, because it's like, that's why there isn't more diversity of all kinds in this business. It's actually classism.
It's financial inequity. Yeah. It's like,
it's
the same idea as like, you know, the food that is affordable is fast food. And therefore that leads to, you know, more heart problems and health issues kind of stuff. It's like, yeah, all of this stuff is systemic, and you know,
and it's cyclical. Economic. Yeah, it's not. It's an economic problem at the root. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting to think about too. Like, okay, how do we like literally fix that? You know, like we talk about a lot at Not Your Daddy's. Like, if we really want to pump more women and non-binary creatives into the industry and positions of power, like, literally, how can we help? What can we do? You know, so it's like, how do you fix that problem?
Well, I So when I got to be the head writer for The Problem with Jon Stewart, we were starting from zero. And John and I had always talked about like how fucked up the actual just pipeline was. So he would say, like, even when I would go to agents and be like, can we have more women? Can we have more people who aren't just white? They would be like, we don't have them. They're not here because they didn't sign them. So it's like the pipeline is broken. And so I was like, can I change the entire packet process to what I always wished it was? And he was like, absolutely. And he made sure I had the budget to do that because it meant I needed someone to blind to do the actual blinding process of 2,000 packets. And that takes work. You have to like put in the release form, you have to take their name off the packet, you have to upload it to this thing. But yeah, there's just actual ways to do it. So we made our first packet 1 page long, which means anyone working a job can do this packet. It is only 1 page. It's only 1 page. I also put it on a holiday weekend. And I did that so it's like maybe you'll have an extra day, but also now the news is really slow. It was like, I don't know, President's Day or something. So the topics you're going to be writing about are harder. So now it's easier for me to read a bunch of 1 page packets because it'll be easier to see who can write jokes. Then I said in the packet, you have to self-submit. An agent can't submit it for you. Because that let people know you're welcome here. Yeah. Like, you're not sneaking in. You're not wasting your time. Like, I want it to be you. And then I started sending it through Facebook groups and friends and being like, this is an open packet for everyone. And that made it reach 2,000. I think, I can't remember the number. It was like 2,300 people. And then to make it through that many packets, it had to only be a page long. So it was just 1 page of jokes. That was the only ask. And and then we read them all blind. That's also how you do it, which is like, and also, by the way, I'm in the middle of like 2,300 blind packets. And I'm like, this, what if I unmask our 10 best writers and they're all white dudes from Harvard? Like, I'm proven. I was so scared. I was like, oh my God. But the other thing we had going for us is that John read the packets. He read a portion of them. In the end, all of them, we had two producers reading them and me, and we were all different ages, different backgrounds, different races. And so, you know, what is funny to different people. So we had different readers too. And then we had a second round that was much harder. And when I tell you, I mean, it is so insane what happened. We hired 7 writers. That's not a lot. There was someone from the South, from the North, from the Midwest. There was a military veteran. There were 2 moms, 6 people. It was their first writing job in TV ever. 6 people did not have reps. It was almost half women, half men. We had every different sexual orientation. We had multiple races and ethnicities.
Cool.
And 7 people.
Wow.
7 people. And I was like, oh my God.
Wow.
Yeah. So. And that is to say, I hope that wasn't super boring, but that is to say, like, there's like just legit ways to change how you can apply to a show. I mean, people, one woman was working for a nonprofit outside of Illinois and got her first job writing on the phone with Jon Stewart and moved to New York City. And she's like crushing it now. But it's like, yeah, who would think that they could apply for a job from Illinois? And I think you have to like make that possible.
Yeah. Oh, my God. No, that's so unboring. That's incredible. That's so incredible.
Most interesting and inspiring.
Yeah, truly.
Thank you. I just, it's so funny. I can always tap into the rage of me trying to get a job when I was 25 being so mad. And I think it's like, yeah, how would you have gotten that job at 25? And it's like, yeah, you just have to make it so that it's possible.
Yeah. And that's true. Like, we talk about this every day. Again, bringing it back to Not Your Daddy's, but, you know, like, as we figure it out, we just want to talk about it because we don't know what the fuck we're doing, you know, like, and nobody does. But we're like, okay, at least as long as we can just talk about it and go through the steps together, maybe other people will feel comfortable enough to try.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And people in that community. Speaking of communities that you have created.
I was going to say, I know the segue back to you. Okay. You have this amazing podcast called Glamorous Trash, where you discuss celebrity memoirs, but you also have conversations about pop culture. So fun that you started this in your bathtub on Instagram.
That's right.
which I'm obsessed with.
Can you give our listeners your podcast origin story?
A dream. Would love to.
I have this text thread of female friends who are all in the business, and we tried to plan a trip together, and it took us 2 years because someone was getting a job or this job. You know, this business is crazy. So for 2 years, we had one date free, which was Valentine's Day.
2020.
Oh, no. But we were all so tired, too, that we were like, we can nap, we can read, then we'll hang, all this stuff. So I had pre-ordered Jessica Simpson's memoir and brought it with me on this trip. And I was in the hot tub reading it. I was obviously wasted. And I was like, the people got to know how good this book is. and I started posting excerpts from my Instagram stories. And immediately, because I had already been in the business a while and had a community, I was getting DMs being like, turn this into a podcast right now, from podcast producers.
Oh my goodness. From day one of it.
Yeah, first hour. I had been really blind to how amazing podcasts could be because the only people I knew with podcasts were comedians. And we spent all our time around comedians. So the last thing I needed driving home from work was like two people just doing bits for an hour unstructured. And so no one had really, not that anyone should have, but I didn't have an entryway into all the incredible podcasts that I now know I was violently missing out on. But like, I knew two things. I knew you go and get writing tips and industry tips from podcasts, or your friends do comedy on them. Like, I did not know about all the other shows. So when they were like, do a podcast, I was like, no. And then like two martinis later, I was like, yes, yes, podcast. I emailed my manager on Valentine's Day. What a brat. I have an idea for a podcast. I had just gotten a new manager who was like a young woman who was just starting out and was like, fuck yes, let's do it. Because I think, I know for sure my past managers would be like, 2 months later, they would have replied, did you actually do this on Valentine's Day? No, that night she was like, let's do it. 3 days later, I had put the pitch together and then we sent it out and it immediately sold to someone who had DM'd me that night.
Cool.
And then the pandemic hit. Mm. And at the same time, so podcast listening went down 40% that first month of pandemic, obviously. Mm. And then it went way the fuck up. But when I was negotiating this contract, they were like, we don't even know if podcasts will be a thing. We can't really offer you any money. And I was like, I don't care. I'll do it for free. I'm freed out. And just the negotiations and the launch date and all this like bullshit took 8 fucking months. And yeah.
Oh no.
I mean, I announced the show in like July on Bitch Sesh, but then we don't even put out a trailer, I think, till September.
Mm-hmm.
And in that time, I kept thinking, I should just do this myself. Like, I can record and edit. I know how to edit. I can do this myself.
Yeah, totally.
But I had this idea of like, but wouldn't it be like so cool to like be on a network and they're going to give me $20,000 in marketing money. Like, oh my God. And so I look back and I wish I had just trusted my instinct, which has been my instinct my whole life, which is just do it yourself. Do it yourself. Mm-hmm. Do it independent. It's always the best way. But I didn't, because I wasn't super educated in the podcast world. And I waited those 8 months. And I think I lost a lot of good pandemic time where people were, my Instagram was popping, but like we didn't have episodes out. And then come to find out that $20,000 is 4 ads. It's 4 ads.
And you're like, I've been waiting for 4 ads.
For 4 fucking ads. And so 4 ads ran for $20,000, and this podcast launches, and a year later, the network is like being bought by someone else. No one's showing up to the recordings. Like, it's becoming like very clear. I have to like go independent or stop the podcast altogether. And that is when I started the Patreon. And I also didn't want to do that because, again, very stupid, very dumb. I was like, no, I don't want to ask people for money. Like, I have so many money issues. I was like,
yeah,
like, am I worth it? Am I worth supporting? And also like, I think when you grow up rich, asking for money is very easy. You're like, yes, of course. I deserve money. Let me go get it. Yay. When you grow up very poor, you don't fucking ask for money. Like, you're trying to save face. You're trying to present that you deserve to be there.
And so I had a lot of issues holding me back from the best thing that ever happened to me, which was starting a Patreon, because that means starting a community. And that's when the podcast really took off and really became something that I'm like so proud of. One, financially, it was able to continue because of the Patreon, but it's all the tools for a community. It's chat groups. It's a way to reach people. It's a way to live stream with them. It's a way to connect with them. And it's the best thing that's ever happened.
And I think that like the money thing, and then also just like wanting people to have access who might not otherwise, like when you were talking about the packets, is something we've talked about with Not Your Daddy's Films. We started there as like just doing screenings and they were all free, but this has slowly but surely become a second full-time job for all of us. And we were like, how quickly, but surely. Yeah. We're like, how do we like justify charging? But then, so basically the conclusion we came to was that we did pay what you can for like almost a year. And then we did like, you know, a low fee. But if you can't, like, at this point, this community is really thriving. And like, we know almost all of these people who are coming through to every event. It's like, email us, DM us if you can't afford it, if you're like out of a job right now and like you can come, you know?
Amazing. So, yeah.
Because we were like, oh, we like need to start charging, but also how do we justify that?
Exact same position on my Patreon. I have a pay what you can option. And Patreon was like, do not do this. You will not make money. You won't make it. Everyone will always choose that option. You won't make any money. But yeah, I just felt so fucking bad. I have kept it up for this whole time. And now I'm getting to the point where I'm like, I think I have to shut it down soon. But
yeah,
so I really feel you. But the other thought I have is like, we've been talking about like, it's like, how do you make change? How do you make change? Well, the only true power in this world is power. And the second power is money. And when women and places like yours get money, you can start swinging that big old money dick around and making change. Yeah. And so it's a good thing for you to make money. Like really that it just think about it as like we are growing our power to like make a bigger impact.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's like such an artist thing of being like, oh, I can't charge, or like
starving.
I'll do it for free or whatever. Yeah, starving artists when you don't come from money. So that, yeah, that's a big thing for us is like, okay, but we are putting in a full-time job. We are truly trying to help people, you know, like it's okay. It has to be okay.
Cause that's, and we will be able to help them if you have resources and the biggest resources.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. True. So recently I was listening to an episode of Glamour Trash where you were talking about like how to write and sell a memoir because you have the book coming out, but you also mentioned this like really fascinating viral Vox article that I immediately went and read called
Sellout.
Yes. It was like both depressing, but then also kind of uplifting.
Oh. So uplifting because you're like, I've been feeling this way. Oh my God. Yeah. Words for it. Yeah.
100%. So if you haven't read the article, it talks about a lot of different things. But one of the things I want to chat about is how social media plays a role in how we discover and consume like art and artists. And then also how artists are like they're in charge of their own marketing in that way, because you have this sort of like direct to consumer thing. And I feel like you've been so great at creating community through social media on your Instagram, with the podcast, with the Patreon, like all these different platforms where people can find each other and find you. So I'm just wondering how you've felt about using social media. Have you always been like pro, or like was it just something like similar to doing it yourself and that mantra you've had for yourself, like that it just fit?
I think what I loved about the article is that I don't think it'll speak to Gen Z creators, but to a millennial creator, I absolutely suffered from the feeling that being on social media is gross and makes you not a real artist, and it makes you like this throwaway idiot influencer, especially as a woman. And so had I fucking known, I would have been popping in 2012. But in 2012 I was still like, I'm an artist, like Instagram's like you should only post once a month, or like you're like really vapid. And really did not see the tool in front of me. And I think it's really painful to say this, but it absolutely happened accidentally. And I don't because I don't think I would have ever been able to talk myself into doing it on purpose. Like, mm-hmm. if you had said, Chelsea, you really need to use social media to grow your podcast, I would have been like, ew. And also, I'm bad at that. Like, I'm not a marketing person. I'm not a social media person. Yeah. I can, like, write and I can create, but, like, I don't even know what you're supposed to do to grow. And so...
That's why your stuff, I think, feels so organic, though, because it is. It's not, like, and I don't mean, like, you're... like, you know, using it like, oh, I'm marketing this. It's just like when I go look at your stuff, I'm like, oh, I feel like I know her. And I feel like I get to, like, you know, think I'm like, oh, I thought the same thing when I read that line or like whatever. And that's really nice.
Love hearing that. Okay, that makes me feel a lot better. Yeah, it really was posting about books just because I just genuinely loved them, and then realizing how I could use Instagram to digitally book club, like you're saying. Like, people would write me DMs and be like, actually, did you know this, though? And then I'd go on a weird rabbit hole and I'd post. Mm-hmm. I think the other thing that really changed for me, and I hope it's good advice because it changed my life, which is that as soon as I looked at social media, not as like, this is my account, but this is my stage. So it's the pandemic. I can't go to an open mic. I can't shoot my short film. I'm going to get up on Instagram stories and perform a bit. I'm going to put the thoughts in my head onto the thing and make it into a story and try and tell jokes. And that's been the only way I've been able to, like, really enjoy being on social media, which is just like, it's just another outlet to perform and make art. But anytime I think of it as like, I should do this trend because it's viral, I immediately fail. And so, yeah, so that's really what changed things for me. And then weirdly, my wedding taught me a lot about Instagram, because I had been book clubbing books. And so then I was like, what is it? What does everyone think about this dress? I was also so stupid about weddings. I was like, is this, so everyone agrees that a $4,000 wedding dress is like cheap? Everyone agreed on that? I just want to check because that feels wrong. And I would put it up on Instagram, and then people would like weigh in and talk about things. And it really just showed me like all the ways you can like express yourself.
Yes, I loved that journey. Harley and I were just at our friend's wedding this weekend, and she got married in Palm Springs. She was my best friend from college. And like the whole leading up to process, she was like, I feel like I don't understand the value of a dollar anymore because everyone is telling me everything's $1 million. And at this point, I'm just like, yeah, sure. Flowers should cost thousands and thousands of dollars.
Yeah, absolutely. And why have we all agreed to this? And why have we agreed to these really dusty wedding traditions that we like don't enjoy anymore? Mm-hmm. And like, but also I do want to have a wedding and I love weddings. So can someone who knows what a wedding is tell me what the goal of a centerpiece is?
Literally. Yeah. Goal of the centerpiece. I do want to quickly talk about your memoir. So how did you approach that differently? Obviously, you're really well versed in the genre, but you were coming from a TV background. Like, was it similar to pitching a show, or did you have to be like, okay, how do I navigate this book space?
It was not similar to pitching a show, because when you're pitching a show, my least favorite part is always when you have to pitch them the pilot, but also they don't actually want to hear the pilot. That was the hardest lesson I've ever had to learn, where it's like, I broke out a whole pilot, but it's not enjoyable to hear the plot beats of a half hour pilot on a Zoom at the very end of a pitch. So you've got to give it to them in a cuter way. And, but you do have to break out all the story points, what happens, blah, 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 blah. With a memoir, I already know what happened. And that's the biggest gift to someone who works in fiction. You're like, well, shit, I know what happened. And so the work was in a totally different way of dealing with my deepest, darkest traumas and how to restructure them when I needed the story to be told in a different way, how to emotionally stabilize in any way in order to write a joke about it. And then probably the hardest is when I could not be funny because the story you just didn't want it. It was just too sad. You'd be like, they would be so, just don't do that to your own story. And I'm a comedy writer. So that was like, those are probably the hardest parts.
How did you even decide to do that? Like, oh, I'm going to write a memoir now.
So oddly enough, I've always wanted to write a memoir. I believed that becoming a TV writer was possible. I did not believe I was ever going to get to write a book. Because you need to be very important to have a memoir. Like, I never thought this could happen. And it's because I loved memoirs. So I've been reading celebrity memoirs since I was a teenager. They've always been my favorite book genre. That's what happens when your nearest bookstore growing up is a Walmart. You know, the hottest collection of just what's Jane Fonda got to say. Her book is great. Anyways, so I always loved memoirs. I always loved them. It felt like those were the women accidentally telling me how to make it in this business. Like, you had to make it through a bunch of other stuff, but they would always have gems in them. I loved them. I love nonfiction. And so I always wanted to do this. And then when I started the podcast, that's those two things came together. And again, I would get emails. Maura, shout out to Maura, who like worked in publishing, sent me an email. She was like, you know, you have a book in you. You know, you could write a book, right? And I was like, yes.
Yeah.
I still didn't believe in myself. I went out and I pitched a coffee table book of my favorite quotes from other books.
No.
Yeah, and everyone was like, no, we don't fucking want that. I can mention the copyright issues. Like, ew, no. And I was like, but I would want to read it. And then finally, one agent was like, just why don't you write? It sounds like you want to write a memoir, write a memoir. And I literally said, can I, you know, I'm like, I'm 35. Like, can I write a memoir? And I was like, would that sell? And he said, I don't know. It depends on how good it is. And I was like,
obsessed.
Okay. So he was like, only way to find out is put together a pitch and write a couple chapters. And I said, you fucking got it. And then I did. Yeah.
Wow.
I love it so much. I also love that, like, real, because to me, that would light a fire under me. Be like, well, then it's going to be really fucking good.
Oh, you know? Yeah, absolutely. The little competitor in me was like, you know.
Yeah. Oh my God, I love that so much. Okay, another thing that I've been like dying to talk to you about, I wanted to talk about Girls 5 Eva. Like, was
a dream
it, like,
show. Yeah.
Working, yeah, on a musical show, because that is so rare. How do you navigate that? How did you get involved with the show? What did you do on the show? Tell us everything.
You know, how I got on the show is a crazy story, and I actually would love to tell it specifically for this podcast.
Right. Yes. Can't wait. This is everything I wanted.
The very first script I ever completed in my life. And I think it's 2011 or 2012, like a full length feature script, was a movie about a highly sexualized 90s teen girl group who get back together when they are 35.
What?
Yes. And it's called The Butterflies with a Z. And I loved it so fucking much. I had readings of it. It was amazing. I just loved it. Then when I got reps, they were like, they legit said the movie Pop Star is coming out, so we can't send this out, which is obviously the most
so
idiotic thing
stupid.
You can say. And a great reminder to let everyone know that your reps are just people. And sometimes they're bad people. So just really take a look at what's being said. Yeah, she was like, well, Pop Star's coming out in 2 years, because she had like someone in it. So she was like, it's coming out in 2 years. So
years.
Yeah. So I was like, okay, this movie's nothing. But I loved it so much. So, and I needed a TV writing agent, or I wanted one. And so I turn it into a half hour sample. And so then it becomes a television show about a teen girl group in the late 90s who reunite when they're 35. Then I love it so much that I write it back into an indie feature. And I'm like, I'm writing this in a way where I could shoot it for $100,000. Like, just give me $100,000. Me and all my friends are going to be in it. I keep moving the years around so that I'm the age where I can be in the show. And like, I think they started out, they were 30, and then they like get 35, like whatever years they were. I was like, it's always my current age. And I then send it to my agents, and I'm like, now I've had this script for like 8 years, and the butterflies, the half hour sample, got me multiple jobs. Everyone would be like, oh my God, I love this script. You know, come for an interview. I send it out. I'm like, here's the indie version. Can you try and get financing? And they were like, yeah. Let us look into it. And 3 days later, hits deadline, Tina Fey and Meredith Scardino have Girls 5 Eva coming out. When I tell you, I feel this is embarrassing, but I think everyone listening is in the arts, so maybe it's not. I mean, I cried as if it like it was a death. It was my very first baby. I dreamt of making it my whole life. I'd made all the storyboards, all the direct, every version I could have made this, I had made for, eight or 9 years. And so I cried for days. I begged them. I was like, please just send it out. And they were like,
no. like Tina Fey is doing it.
My heart is like for you.
No, yeah, I wanted, it was so painful and probably like, oh, you know, there's these big brush strokes in your career that just make you so jaded. And that's one of the biggest ones for me where you just like, I just died. And 5 months later, we are now fully in the pandemic and they're looking for their last two writers for Girls Five Eva. And because we're in the pandemic, they have now opened up the writer's room to writers in LA because it was supposed to be a New York room. Yeah. And David Miner emailed me and was like, will you send me your half hour sample, which was still The Butterflies? And I sent it to him. And then he sent it to Meredith, who created Girls Five Ever, who read it. And there's two jokes in there that are like the word for word, the exact same joke. And she was like, oh my God, get her on the show. So then I get on this Zoom with her and Tina, and she was like, so you wrote this premise. And I just like, I could see it going so many different, I could see someone getting that script and being like, fuck you, get out of here. Like your weird version is stupid. And instead she was like, get on in here and like help us write this show. And then I got to write on it.
That's so cool. So amazing.
And it has a lot of heartbreak in it, which is why I guess I like telling that story of like, having your manager shit on it, having it never be sent out, changing it, multiple different forms. Someone more famous does it first. Then you finally get to write it. It's like, which feels very this business.
Oh, it so is. So when you're on the show, like, A, for Butterflies, did you have like original music in it too?
Yes, I had written the songs and I had gone to our musical composer for the Second City Touring Company, Tara Trudell, who's done all the music for my films. And she had composed music for me. And then this is the year I wrote it in. I had put up like a slideshow with her songs playing to like, I don't know, the ugliest clip art in the world.
Dad.
Yeah, and I would send that around with the pitch. And then Girls Five Ever, which by the way, is the funniest show of all fucking time. I know I wrote on season one, but then I left to go work for John. And season two and season three are like incredible and it's so fun to watch. And I think really special about the show is that is Tina Fey's husband writing the music.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And Sarah Bareilles too. But like, who else would you want to write not only genuinely good songs, but then also comedic songs? And then we wrote the lyrics in the room, in the writer's room.
Oh, that's what our next question was. That's so cool.
Literally, that was going to be my next question. That's so fun. So I made a short film during the pandemic that is also a musical comedy. And I wrote all the music with my brother, who is a musician as well. But there was just something about like having literally all the time in the world. Where it was just like, why not? Why not do every single little piece of this? And it was so fun and it taught me so much, you know?
Really, it can work. It's like people like to forget about Glee and Nashville and Girls Five Ever and Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. Like, yes, this can work. Yes, it works.
It works.
Yeah, people love it. People
love it. Nashville.
Let's keep going with the musical shows.
So you talked a little bit about reps in that story. How do you navigate reps as, I mean, a writer, but also, I guess, a multi-hyphenate, and also, like, you don't just want to staff on things. You have stuff that you are taking out and selling. Because I think there are, like, people don't really think about that. There are some writers who are like, I'm not interested in selling my own stuff. I'm more interested in staffing on other people's shows. So how do you find the right team? Because they are just people. So, you know, it's a little like dating.
I mean, it's so tough because when I give my genuine advice, I know younger me would not have listened, but I'll give it anyway. And it sucks. It sucks because when you just want a break, you're just like, I just need a rep. Literally, if like a turtle showed up and was like, I know some people, I'd be like, here you go. You're now my manager. Like, just anybody. It is true. The right reps will find you. And but key to that is if you're extremely putting yourself out there. Shows, social media, short films, all of that. Then the right reps come to you. You definitely can't just like sit and wait. And I had the wrong reps for 5 years. And I was just always so afraid. I was just so afraid to be without reps. I was always nobody. I never had any reason why anyone else would ever sign me. So I just thought like, I gotta stick it out. Mm-hmm. And the moment I finally got the courage to fire them, my entire career changed. And not only that, I took on another manager and then had to fire him 8 months later. But by the time I learned how to do it once, I was like, all right, we're back in business.
And I had to fire two agents as well. And when I also say fire, like one of those managers, I remember being like, here's what I'm really looking for. And he was like, oh, then we should probably like, then I'm probably not the fit for you. And then I was so shook by that. Like, I thought I was giving us a pep talk, like, I need this, I need this, I need this. And he was like, get away from me. And I wasn't ready for that. So I remember I didn't think it was a breakup call. So I'm like driving in my car like that. I thought we were just like going about business. And then he's just sort of like, yeah, it sounds like you don't like me, so you should like just go away. And I, on God, this is what I say, because I was so shocked. I was like, oh, okay, well, see you when I see ya. Because I didn't know what. So he really did fire. I do think technically he probably fired me. And I just said the words. But yes, your reps are the most incredible people in the world. In the world, when it's a fit, they're the most incredible people. And when it's not a fit, they're the person you hate in the morning, noon, and night. And so it's so important that it's a fit. And you really, the two things I always, that really worked for me is like, one, think of it like dating. And if you settle with an okay boyfriend, you are going to have an okay time. Like he's never going to become incredible in bed if he's not at first. I mean, okay, maybe, I don't know, but probably not, probably not.
Probably not.
And you've got it, like, you want to fall in love. You want to be like, oh my God, you do this business the way I want to do this business. And so, which also means you have to be single if you're not meeting the right person. And then the other thing I'll think about is that really helps me is pretend you genuinely are an agent. And like, I have to sell somebody. And someone is like, I wrote a script with my friend. We have an idea for a short film, and I have a show once a month, right? I'd go, I don't know what to do. But if you were like, here's three scripts, three ideas. I wrote them solo. I did these festivals. I produced this short film. You can watch it right now. It is only 1 minute long. I'd be like, okay, here we go. Now I'm going to call my friend who I know likes rom-coms. I'm going to send him your short film. And then I'm going to say, I have the full feature script ready to go if you like this 1 minute short film, which is very easy to watch. But I just think it's just like, how would you sell you? And then you have to make sure you are sellable, because their job is sales. It's not giving you notes on projects. The notes they're giving you on projects are so that you can sell them.
Well, yeah, and that's really good advice to think of yourself like, okay, if I'm the agent, how am I selling this person? Because they don't make money unless you make money.
No, and if you are not sellable, you're going to have a hard time getting jobs. And I think that's the hardest part about this, because no artist is good at sales. It's our worst quality.
Yes, and the film that you used in that story, you have the short film called Basic that I think is so funny and great, and was at South by Southwest, and it is so short. Is it a minute?
It is. Yeah, it is 3 minutes long.
Yeah,
3 minutes and 30 seconds long.
So smart.
But that changed my life, because one thing I had no idea about, because I was only making it for me. That agent who was like, you should go away, was like, well, do something for yourself then, and like hung up the phone, and I was like, I will. And I make this 3 minute film. I didn't know that when you were programming a festival, how wonderful a 3 minute film is, because you can fit it into a lot of half hour slots. But had I made like a 7 minute film or a 10 minute film or a 12 minute film, I bet I wouldn't have been in as many festivals as I was. Because of the time. And then when my incredible agent, Anna Flickinger, was like, this 3 minute film went to South by, she set up 30 meetings off of it, because watching 3 minutes was so easy. Okay. All she had to do is email them and be like, it is 3 minutes long. I promise you need to watch it. And you go, okay, I'll click it. But if someone sends you something, they say it's a half an hour. It's incredible. It's incredible. It's a half hour. You just go, okay, well, I'll do that at a different time. Let me pin that. Let me, you know, me too. Blah, 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 blah. And I think when you are starting out, you really need it to be easy to click.
Yes. I love that.
We have learned that time and time again, running our short film screening series every other month. So now, like, all of us do is watch short films. And it's like, if a 3 minute one came up, everybody's watching that immediately.
Yeah, that's so nice to hear. Yeah, of course. You guys are like experts in this programming.
Well, yeah, and we tell people like 15 minutes or less because we want to have as many as we can fit in the block. Watching so many, like, I think Carly and I can both reiterate exactly what you just said, which is like, your film doesn't need to be longer. It you can always have a 10-minute version and you can probably find a shorter version.
Yeah. And it's the hardest thing to do in the world. The hardest thing to do in the world is a lot of other stuff. But something that is hard is you make a 15-minute film, cut it to 5. And you think impossible, because you're so close to it. But that is why it's so impressive when you can do it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. When you can really tell a story. And make it move. It's an impressive talent. And yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you've given us so much of your time. We're having such a good time. We just want to end with a little not so rapid fire.
I'm ready.
Okay. The clock starts now. Boom. Okay. New York or LA?
LA.
Best Real
Housewives. But also neither. Okay. Keep going.
Do you watch Real Housewives? And if so, which is your favorite franchise?
Hands down, Salt Lake City, the most incredible television I've ever watched in a long time.
Great. Love it.
Lipstick or lip gloss?
Lip gloss, the Tarte Juicy Lip Plump has been life-changing. I bought 7 of them.
Okay, plug. Cool. Let's go. Somebody sponsor her.
Give me money.
Favorite celebrity memoir?
Way too hard to answer, but I'll just name some off the top of my head that I really love. Gabrielle Union's first memoir, Demi Moore, Jane Fonda, Rosie Perez. A recent one, Paris Hilton's, was really good.
Great.
Your favorite podcast right now?
Oh my God, impossible. There's so many. Okay, for books, The Stacks. For laughing my fucking ass off, Fixing Famous People. I love it so much. And their podcast in our Patreon community, Chris, who started that podcast, was in my Patreon and was like, I'm thinking of starting a podcast. And I put him on my podcast and now he has a huge podcast.
Amazing.
And it's really good. And I was like, oh my God, I'm so glad I did that because I look forward to this podcast every week.
That's so fun. Movie that you could watch over and over and over again.
Practical Magic, While You Were Sleeping, First Wives Club, and Love and Basketball.
Ugh. Great choices.
So good.
Oh my God. Is there a woman or non-binary director that you're loving right now?
Yes, again, so many. Well, let me know. Kenzie Elizabeth, who is my best friend, but she just made a short film and I was like, oh, it's just so good. And it's so cool to see people just like making it work on their own for $2. I thought Leah McKendrick's Scrambled was just a total, because she was in it. What a feat. Sharon Horgan, always.
Obsessed with her.
What is your favorite Halloween costume you've ever dressed up as?
I hate Halloween.
Ooh,
sorry. You want to hear my rudest opinion ever? And everyone's gonna be like, I thought we liked her, but now we hate her. Halloween's for the people who can't do it year round. And you know what? I'll wear a crown to brunch. I don't need a Halloween. So
I think everyone loves you more now. That's so true.
That's so real.
Okay. This is not a rapid fire, but can you think of any good advice you've received from a mentor that you'd want to leave with our listeners?
So much. So let me think.
Yeah. Take your time.
This is the recent advice I got that I've been thinking about a lot. And it comes from my friend Asher, who is a cartoonist and was at the Second City. And I actually think he meant this advice in a different way. It was in a text, but I interpret it as this. This is the advice. Where you go, you will end up. Which is to say, sometimes when I look around and I'm like, all I'm doing is podcasting and reading books. It's like, well, I started a podcast where you read books. And sometimes when I was like, how am I working in late night comedy when my dream was to write female focused films? Well, you wrote a bunch of packets and ended up in late night and worked a bunch of late night jobs. And so it's a really good reminder of like, where are you putting all of your energy? Because that is building the ladder to where you are headed. Are you putting your energy in the place you want to be going?
That's such great.
Such good advice. Okay. And then last final thing, you're going to the movies. What are you getting at the concession stands?
I'm getting a giant popcorn with butter and I'm getting a Sprite. And then I'm eating all the hard parts off the popcorn, holding the soft parts in my hands like a gross person. And then I'm eating soft parts and drinking the Sprite.
Incredible.
What an incredible thing to end on. So just couldn't be more specific. God, that was amazing.
Thank you guys so much for having me. This was just such a joy. And I love what you're doing with your community.
Oh, thank you. If you guys want to check out more of Chelsea, please listen to Glamorous Trash. Get her book. Is there anything else you want to plug? Where can they follow
my book? It's titled I Shouldn't Be Telling You This, because I also read the audiobook. So if you like podcasts, it's my longest podcast yet. And you can follow me at Chelsea Devantes on Instagram, where I sometimes book club memoirs.
Incredible. Amazing. You can follow us at NYD Films on Instagram and TikTok. I'm at Geeka Stubbs.
And I am at the Carly Tamarin. The spelling is weird, so just maybe look it up first.
Just good luck to you.
Yeah, good luck to you.
We'll see you next time.
Yes.
Bye. Daddy Dailies is presented by Not Your Daddy's Films, a social impact organization dedicated to educating and empowering women and non-binary creatives in TV and film. If you like what you heard today, don't forget to subscribe and leave us a positive review. If you want more Daddy episode insights and links to what we talked about, join us on Patreon/NYD Films. Daddy Dailies is produced in partnership with Robert Bailey and edited by Carly Tamarin, Fika Stubblebine, Claudia Restrepo, and Gracie Strauss. See you next time, Daddy.